My guest today, Lila Rajiva, is a freelance journalist and author of The Language of Empire, Abu Ghraib and the American Media, published by the Monthly Review Press last year, which was the first book that focused on the media cover-up of Abu Ghraib and has been praised by media activists as a model of citizen journalism. Her work has frequently been circulated on Dissident Voice, Alternet, Counterpunch, Anti-War, and Lou Rockwell. She holds a master's in international relations from Johns Hopkins and has taught at the University of Maryland and Towson University. She is currently co-authoring a book on politics, The Public Spectacle, with libertarian financial commentator Bill Bonner, which is due from John Wiley in fall 2007. Welcome, Lila Rajiva.
Thank you, Jeff. Glad to be here.
I'm glad to hear from you in Buenos Aires. Well, let's start off. Donald Rumsfeld is much in the news these days, probably more than he wants to be, with six former generals, including several who served in Iraq, calling for him to resign. Why don't you tell us more about the role and degree of responsibility that Rumsfeld had for the torture of Iraqi prisoners that took place at Abu Ghraib?
Yes, Rumsfeld has had a large role in what has happened, and it actually precedes the Iraq torture scandal. He was not popular for something called the Revolution in Military Affairs, RMA, where he tried to transform the entire military according to a new model of how it should function, a model that was basically borrowed from business, which involved cutting costs, streamlining, trying to move to a kind of a high-tech battlefield awareness, emphasis on high technology, reducing the actual number of human beings in place in some places. Theoretically, it sounds excellent. It sounds like a parallel track to the kinds of privatization initiatives that were going on in the 90s. In practice, many of the generals were vehemently opposed to the RMA and thought it wouldn't work, and it didn't work, that it was pushed through very intemperately without taking into account any of their concerns. And so he had already created or provoked an opposition to his methods within the military before Abu Ghraib came along. But Abu Ghraib was another aspect of this intense push that he brought to the military to quicken the pace of everything that needed to be done, which ultimately led to the kinds of problems we saw. Part of Abu Ghraib, and not all of it, but part of it was certainly caused by the cost-cutting emphasis of that Rumsfeld brought to the military, and the emphasis on privatizing and putting out a lot of the military work to private contractors. If you recall, many of the interrogators who were guilty of having at least set the tone at Abu Ghraib were not really part of the military hierarchy. They were contractors. Several companies, or at least a couple of companies, were directly involved in that. And the most relevant issue of that is private contractors don't fall under the regular military chain of command, so they don't have that same kind of accountability in any way. And so they can't be governed by the laws and regulations of the military, and that certainly directly led to Abu Ghraib. So Rumsfeld, apart from his role in authorizing certain torture techniques, and that was a very prominent role as well, has a long-standing involvement in a cost-cutting effort, which I think was part of the reason why the interrogation techniques went basically haywire and were not subject to any kind of control. His role in the creation of those memos also is those torture memos, the memos which authorized certain techniques, is also well-known. It has been right from the beginning. When Abu Ghraib broke as a scandal in 2004, and that was at the end of April, within a couple of weeks, actually, it was apparent that Rumsfeld's role was very central. In fact, a couple of hearings were called on May 7th and May 11th of that summer, and every newspaper in the country was basically calling for Rumsfeld's head to roll because it was apparent that he must know what was happening for some time. He had to have known what was for some time and had not really taken it seriously. And his reaction was, well, we know the extent of the abuse and so on. And that's simply untrue. The complaints have been coming from Amnesty International, several Human Rights Watch, and several other groups for at least a year and a half, going directly up to him. And even then, he, far from taking them seriously and slowing down the process, examining what was going wrong, he actually was calling to intensify the interrogation process, And the very the previous year, at the time period which Abu Ghraib is supposed to have, I mean, the abuses actually took place, the fall of 2003, he was the one who called for General Miller to go to Abu Ghraib, to Iraq, and Gitmoize it, which is basically bring from Guantanamo the same techniques that we now know were abusive, bring them to Iraq as well. So despite all the complaints from human rights people, Rumsfeld went ahead and did that. He's ultimately responsible for that movement of Miller from Guantanamo to Iraq. So there are at least three or four distinct areas of responsibility, the RMA on the most general level, the cost-cutting, privatization, all that, which had, you know, there was a decade-long struggle about that in the military. Number two was the actual okaying of certain techniques, including the use of dogs, prolonged standing, and isolation, and so on. Number three was the skidmoreization, which he had to take place. And, of course, the fact that he denied. And that's a serious responsibility, too. He denied having known all these things. If he had, in fact, admitted at the hearings that he had made a mistake, apologized in some way, but his apology was basically meaningless, and there was no attempt to reprimand any of the generals who were involved, Sanchez, Miller, none of these people were reprimanded. They were, in fact, rewarded.
Well, it did actually affect Sanchez's promotion situation, but Miller has been almost absolved in the media, and the only person who has actually taken a fall was Janice Karpinski. Maybe you could talk about a little
Janice
bit about
Karpinski,
that.
Yes. Yeah, Sanchez, yeah, was not given the four star, but Rumsfeld was kind of insistent that he be given it anyway, but I don't really think there was a serious reprimand of Sanchez either. The person who took the fall, as you said, was Janice Karpinski. And if you go back and look at Karpinski's role in it, it was not major. She appeared to have, most of the accounts actually do substantiate what she was saying, which was that they were overburdened there. The complaints that they were making to senior officers were not being taken seriously. And there was a division of the chain of command. I mean, the military intelligence came in and basically took over the place. And soldiers were left in a quandary. They weren't really sure who was above them. So, they can fudge it and they can dump the blame on her, but in fact she's been made the fall guy, in my opinion.
Now, it's interesting, we're talking about the mention of private contractors. There's a trial going on now. Saddam Hussein and other Iraqi officials are being tried for the murder of 184 Shia as part of an assassination plan against him during the Iraq-Iran war, and they claim that Saddam and the Iraqi officials claim this was revenge or taking action because of the assassination attempt. But it's curious, after the assassination or the murder of four U.S. private contractors, the U.S. exacted revenge on the city of Fallujah. Was there any difference?
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, a disproportionate retaliation is a war crime. And you have to remember that those four Americans who were, their bodies were burnt and dragged on the streets, an enraged Iraqi crowd. That didn't come out of nowhere. That whole previous month, there had been reports of very violent, aggressive tactics being used in rounding up people in their homes. There had been reports coming out of Abu Ghraib. Remember, though, we did not know about Abu Ghraib till end of April 2004. The Iraqi civilians were well aware of it for at least a year and a half before that. So that had been enraging the population. That was one. Number two, you must remember that those Americans were not innocent bystanders. They were mercenaries. They were paid fighters, basically, private contractors who had developed, gained a reputation in Iraq for being fairly ruthless in their tactics. So what happened to them was a kind of retaliation to begin with on the part of the Iraqi crowd. They were retaliating for their manhandling by U.S. soldiers. They're retaliating for Abu Ghraib, for incessant rumors that women had been raped and that there were all kinds of sexual assaults going on. And so that was the retaliation for them. But then again, in turn, the U.S. used that as an excuse to go ahead and basically lay siege to and raise Fallujah. And we all know how that proceeded. Even of itself, that kind of retaliation against civilians and against the civilian population is a war crime. But we know also that specific war crimes, like the use of what's it called, white phosphorus, were committed there.
And denied even after that it was used white phosphorus, it was forgotten by the media. How has the media, and you talk about the media in the book, how did the media handle Abu Ghraib? And did it deserve some of the accolades? After all, CBS held on to the story till they found out that Seymour Hersh was going to break it.
Yes, I mean, I would give accolades to some journalists, but not the media in general. There were certain journalists. The AP's reporter, Charles Hanley, right from 2002, reported about torture. He had very good stories about it, and you know, there were individual articles that were run in the Washington Post. Washington Post Dana Priest was also very much on top of it. But you see, these were individual articles that would just appear and then disappear. There was no follow-up, no kind of context given. You were told, okay, this happened, and that's it. No follow-up, no coverage, nothing being taken up by other newspapers. And the impression one gets from reading through these individual accounts that kind of pepper the past track record on this issue, through them you get the impression, okay, there were brave individual reporters who kind of stuck their neck out and tried to do the right thing. But then newspaper policy, editorial guidelines prevent them going further. Somebody called them to the office and talked to them, and the story was not followed up or dropped or whatever. Where you see a complete picture is in the foreign press, particularly The Guardian and The Independent, and you see it in the alternative media, among bloggers, among activists. A lot of this is of these smaller web outlets carried lots of these accounts. And now the general opinion is that web blogging or blogging is highly inaccurate. But that's simply a bit of a slander, because if you look at the mainstream media, was far more inaccurate than any bloggers. For instance, the white phosphorus story out of Fallujah was broken by bloggers, both in Britain and in the U.S., who did the kind of research that we normally expect from journalists. They went into the Army's own records and showed that white phosphorus was actually documented to have been used. That's the kind of research that a major newspaper should be putting out through their journalists and through their analysts, but they're not doing it. And it's not because of lack of resources. It's perhaps partly due to the danger of the situation, yes. But, you know, that's the job of a journalist. And a lot of stories could have been broken really without having to go out onto the field. A clever journalist should have been able to spot the discrepancies that were in the press releases put out by the government. You can actually write the story of Abu Ghraib by looking at newspaper accounts and what the government is saying, and you'll quickly see the flaws in what's happening. You'll find out that it has to have been a lie, this has to have been a lie, that has to have been a lie, because if you create a big picture out of it, you can see it. And that's just what I did. It's not, I didn't go to Iraq and turn over any rocks and find worms there. I watched the media, and in fact, the CBS show, when it first came on, my initial reaction, like anybody, was, oh, this is not something that the U.S. military would do. This is a mistake. These kids were caught doing something ridiculous. But on the other hand, as I watched it more closely, I realized there's got to be something wrong, because how can men be raped in jails and women not be? How did kids from the rural Virginia and Maryland come up with this really bizarre way of torturing Arab males? It just didn't ring true that it should have been just some animal house pranks going on. It looked much more systematic. And it could not. And if that happened in one place, it must have happened elsewhere. And lo and behold, of course, that was the case. So you don't really have to have journalists on the ground in Iraq. That helps, obviously. But if you just have people who are alert and do their job and call the government on its press releases, because that's all the government puts out, then you do get to the truth. So there was some coverage by some individual journalists, but not enough to give you a sustained picture, and always leaving you with the impression that this was a mistake. It was going to be fixed. It's nothing broad, nothing very broad, not a policy. And that's not true. It was a policy.
Well, actually, something you said brings back the issue of bloggers. I remember during the Israeli invasion of Jenin in 2002, a website called Debka, which seems to have connections to Israeli intelligence, but it's an Israeli website, yes, reported that U.S. Marines were accompanying Israeli soldiers in Jenin, and I actually thought that was far-fetched. It turned out to have been correct. Perhaps you wrote in your book, The Language of Empire, the role that Israel's played in assisting the United States in both in the torture regime as well as other aspects of the confrontation and the occupation of Iraq. Perhaps you could talk about that.
Yes, the role of Israel has recently come in for a lot of review. I think people are jumping on it now. You know, there's a lot of talk, especially after the Dubai ports deal. People have talked about the dual citizenship and involvement and so on and so forth. And there's always, let me make the caveat, that there's always a risk when we talk like that of running into, not only being perceived as anti, which is, of course, one sort of problem, but also ending up being a little anti-Semitic in the sense that we may oversize the role of Israel. Start with that caveat. Having said that, yes, Israeli policy has been closely intertwined with U.S. policy on this. We had U.S. soldiers involved in training camps at Jenin. That was in 2002. The guy in charge of who actually briefed General Miller, debriefed General Miller when he came back from Iraq, was General Boykin, Jerry Boykin, William Boykin. And he has had something of has been quite notorious for his comments, which come out of a very militant Christian evangelical tradition, in which he has termed, from which he has termed Islam, demonic, Muhammad, Islam satanic. What else has he said? That this is a religious war and my God is bigger than his God and so on and so forth, comments like that. And people have criticized it, but Rumsfeld stood by the man thoroughly. And when you have that background, Boykin, who's not only a militant Christian evangelist in this sense, he's also been involved in a lot of special missions of a very kind of spectacular variety. He was in the hunt for Pablo Escobar. He was in the Black Hawk Down fiasco as well. And so the fact that he had a large role to play in Abu Ghraib is indicative of Rumsfeld's emphasis as part of this RMA on special ops, on things that sort of go around the traditional military structure. And each time the media unearths one sort of covert operation, the covert operation just changes its name and goes into a different department and continues. And people like Boykin, and not only Boykin, by the way, Peter Pace, General Shoemaker, a lot of these individuals, if you look back into their history, have been closely allied with special ops, and their preeminence in this time in the military is indicative of this whole new emphasis on the private, the covert, the non-traditional way of doing things. So Boykin, as I said, was in special ops, was also a militant Christian evangelical, and was also part of the team that went to Israel and was involved in these kinds of joint preparatory exercises. There were also a number of accounts that Israelis were seen, were present, Israeli soldiers were present at Abu Ghraib. Some of these remain allegations, and of course, Israel has denied them. Now, the similarity of torture methods is not, I think, coincidental, but here is where I think we can overlay the role of Israel. The fact that the U.S. has used sexualized torture sexualized torture techniques as far back as 1960s. It's in the Kubark training manual, which was developed then and which was used to train Secret Service and police in many countries, including Latin America, Central America, and the Shah's Savak in Iran. So we can kind of overemphasize the Israeli input into that. Before the Israelis, the U.S. had already developed these sexualized torture techniques, this business of humiliating people by catching them in sexual positions or stripping them, using the photos to compromise them or blackmail them, especially in a traditional country. All that had been actually developed in the 50s and 60s here in the U.S. itself. We didn't really need the Israelis to help us do that. But having said that, yes, the techniques used do parallel. And of course, just about the same time when we in the U.S. were starting to debate whether, after all, we could use torture, and that was in 2001 after 9/11, when we were starting to do that, in Israel too, a debate had taken place, and the Israeli Supreme Court, after first denying the role of torture, had kind of let it in through the back door, so to speak. So yes, there's a parallel track. There is interconnection. There is input. But again, we don't want to overemphasize and say, well, America needed Israel to borrow those techniques, torture techniques, because they were developed on our own, basically. Yeah,
and obviously, the Phoenix program in Vietnam which was a major torture, murder, assassination program, was a wholly American operation.
Yeah, wholly American, exactly. So that's, I think that we have to be careful of yes, the Israelis are jumping in. They are a small country, and they're taking advantage of the fact that our policies are coinciding or using or going in the same direction as theirs. Now, of course, now we get into the territory of what was the motive of the whole Iraq war and so on and so forth. But whatever the motive is, and there are all kinds of people who will say they were economic and so on, I tend to believe it was larger than, much more than something like oil. I really don't quite buy that. I think maybe there were geostrategic, a broader desire to get power in the region. But I do believe that there was an ideological position that was had its origin maybe in Israeli policy, for the need to have pro-Israel governments in these areas. And so, that's the reason they're still beating the drum for Iran. And that ideology has a religious component in it. And that's the part which I think hasn't been discussed enough. People have shied away from it. It's not so much that we needed the Israelis to teach us about torture, but if you look, I think there is also a certain kind of, we've talked about Christian fundamentalism, but there's also an element of Jewish fundamentalism behind this, its role in the ideology and the religious beliefs of the settlers and the right wing of the Israeli government, the Likudniks. We don't talk much about the kinds of religious beliefs they have and how those religious beliefs coincide with the Christian Zionists here, and that's really the important story. We talk about Christian Zionism, but not enough about actually the beliefs of the Israeli Jews who support this policy.
And you raise some important points here, because we're the same kind of war drums, the same cast of characters who beat the drums for the war on Iraq are now doing the same for Iran, which would be even a far greater disaster than what the Iraq War has been. And there is some discussion that is beginning on this, and I was hoping, I said earlier in the program, that I would hope that these generals who are protesting or calling for the resignation of Rumsfeld have in the back of their mind their opposition to an airstrike on Iran, because they know what would happen in the aftermath to U.S. troops in Iraq and so on, and how, what would happen to the oil economy should there be a full-blown war, or what Iran would retaliate.
Well, Jeff, this morning I was actually sitting here watching gold shoot up and energy shoot up, and oil has topped 72 or whatever dollars a barrel. Gold went over 62, at least the gold ETF, $62. I think it's at 650 spot gold price. So this is happening even while the market is recovering. So you have a very unusual, the indicators are really haywire. Normally, if today's news was that inflation was not as bad as they had thought, consumers had spending high and all that. But yesterday's PPI was a little lower than expected. But gold shot ahead anyway. That tells you something. It's not really reacting anymore to inflation or what Bernanke is doing, the Fed chairman is doing. It's really not reacting to that. It's reacting to geopolitical tension and the belief that if we go to war with Iran, oil is going to be disrupted. Oil prices are going to soar. And now, who's calling whose bluff, I don't know. But we're playing a really dangerous game here. We are a debtor nation. Our debt is held by China and other Asian countries. At any moment, we could suffer the consequences of whatever Chinese, the Asian central banks may choose to do with their dollar purchases or their future dollar purchases, in which case we'll be there to hold our debt. Are we trying to preempt some possible future scenario like that by now going to war with Iran? I don't think so. I think we will precipitate a crisis, obviously, which again means that whoever is running the government's policy, whoever is concocting it, is really not doing this for any interest, national interest or economic interest, Israeli or U.S., that I can spot. It seems to be completely against anybody's economic interests. It seems really that you have ideologues who have decided beforehand that this is the way we want the world to look. We want to topple these governments. And that's really what the project of the new American century had spelled out. And they're just going ahead regardless of the consequences. And I have to believe there's a certain amount of, almost maybe religious fervor in all this, religious belief that this is the right way to go about it. It's scary because, when you're talking about irrational people like that, to get into, when you have made a mess of Iraq, which would be just an appetizer next to Iran. Iran would be a far larger country, and with ties to China, with with India, there was also that oil pipeline, that gas pipeline that was being discussed. So I don't know what any rational purpose could be achieved by an attack on Iran, but they're certainly making the sounds as though they're going in there.
One of the more ominous statements by one of the leading neo-clerists, Michael Ledeen, was that we believe in creative destruction. He says, yes. Creative destruction is our middle name. And this is not only frightening people in this country and in the Middle East, but obviously in Europe as well. They really don't know how to handle this kind of America. You speak in the book about American exceptionalism, which we see expressed at least once a week, in which an American president, any president, feels it's in his power to tell some country in the world what they should or shouldn't be doing. How did this play out in Abu Ghraib, and how is it playing out in general today?
Naomi Klein actually made a comment that I found very illuminating. She said something to the effect that, regarding torture it was, I think, she said, every other country says never again, but in regard to, evils like torture. And in America, it's not a question of never again. It's, we never have done this. This is not until now. We've never done these sorts of things before. And that's, I think, the fundamental quality of exceptionalism in America. I don't want to say that Americans are the only people who think they're exceptional. Every culture has a history of chauvinism, or strain of chauvinism, which, given the right people coming into power, gets expressed. There are two dangers with American exceptionalism. One is the simple one, which is it really doesn't matter if the Republic of Chad thinks it's exceptional because it's not the most powerful country in the world. It does matter what America thinks because its policies affect everybody else. There's never in the history of the world been such a unipolar situation where one power is so completely dominant militarily, maybe not economically, but militarily, and where that country is so armed that if it wanted to, it could blow the world up several times over. Okay, so that's number one, why American exceptionalism matters. Number two is because American exceptionalism is not just cultural. It's not a question of thinking our culture is the best. That would be relatively harmless, and I think that, again, is found everywhere. There's been a strain in American history where the government, the state of America, has been conflated with the new Israel, the new Jerusalem, if you wish to call it that, as a kind of the city on the, what's it called? The
city on a hill, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So it's the question that the state has been seen. The American state has been seen as the kind of hand of God on the earth. When you get into, if you go to a third world country, developing country, people have a complete skepticism about the government. And so whatever wrongdoings the government is up to, people tend to see through it. The propaganda is very obvious. Politicians are regarded as scoundrels. Now, in the U.S., that is not the case. People seem to think of the government as their daddy or something. They turn to it for help. Maybe it's because government functions to some extent more successfully than elsewhere. Whatever it is, there's this conflation of the state with the good in a very, Hegelian way that is frightening, and that's what gives rise to an exceptionalism which has political implications, and that's the difference. So there's a feeling when Abu Ghraib shows up on our screens, we tend to think, oh, Americans could never do that. I myself, as an immigrant who came to the U.S., I found myself doing that. Oh, American soldiers would never do that. I just couldn't. I couldn't make that click. I could see that other soldiers might do it, but I too had become brainwashed to that extent because actually our propaganda is so good. It's so subtle. It's so powerful. It's so all pervasive, and I think that's an element we don't realize. It's not that other countries don't wish to deceive. They do. But they just are not able to do it so completely because corporations, the corporate media does not create such an environment that there's no way to escape from it. If I had the internet, I would be just as taken in by it as anybody else, despite training, despite having lived abroad and so on and so forth. It's extremely difficult to get away from it. So if you take the average American citizen, it's not a question of their being stupid or immoral or wanting to support evil. They are so thoroughly indoctrinated in a particular worldview which they cannot escape. It's there in all the major mainstream media, publications, on the networks. They all rely on very few sources, and those sources are controlled and manipulated in a certain way. The bias is so prevalent. You can't really escape from it unless you spend substantial time abroad, which most Americans don't.
Well, it's interesting. I've lived in various places in Europe, and where they have national newspapers that go from the extreme left to the extreme right. So every day there may be 9 or 10 newspapers that people can choose, and these newspapers are sold in every kiosk all across the country, in islands like Sardinia or Sicily. You get the same newspaper someone is buying in Rome. Here in the United States, we have local newspapers. The USA Today is not really a national newspaper. It sells selectively in places where it can sell. But you go around the country in small town America, and you get no news at all. I mean, it's simply probably the most misinformed population of any, of any country in the world. You add to that the fact the United States has not experienced a war on its soil since the Civil War, and that's a frightening experience, or frightening for the rest of the world, because Americans are, you know, are constantly being asked, should we bomb Iran, should we bomb, I mean, not just now, but back in 1978 as well, we're constantly being asked, should we drop a nuclear weapon on Libya or so on. Americans simply don't know what war is all about, and having fought in a war as a soldier is not the same as being fighting, having an occupying army in your country, or being bombed at home.
Yeah, and I think that naivety is frightening. It really truly is. Even the discussion about nuclear weapons, just this morning, here I am in Argentina, and I'm staying in with a family, and the grandmother in the family, a woman who doesn't speak English or anything like that, she's very politically aware. She knows what's happening. She asked me about what weapons were used in the Iraq war. She said, are they contemplating using nuclear weapons? She was a bit confused about details. She's very up, alert, knows what's happening in a way that I wouldn't be able to find that in the U.S. unless somebody had an active interest in politics. The average person wouldn't know certain things, or wouldn't be interested, or would accept what the government says uncritically, which is frightening. Another thing that you mentioned about local news not being practically, you know, non-existent, the other thing is that so much of our news is actually not news at all. It's we have this phenomenon of video news releases, which is actually public relations put out by various, which are not explained, I mean, it's not explained to the people watching that, hey, this is not news, this is not journalism, this is not critical. This is a release given by some company sold all over the country as news. And the government does that a lot of the time. And the reason why I wrote the book on the media, I mean, rather than on the torture itself, for me, the ultimate, the flaw, the reason why this is all happening is because the media has become so much a handmaiden of corporate interests. Not to say that the corporate interests in and of themselves need necessarily be bad, but it's when you have no competitiveness, these mergers where just a handful of corporations control all access to news, I mean all news that's being put out, and you just don't get the diversity of views, you don't get the kinds of topics, or all kinds of topics are not included. You're not addressing the whole spectrum of the population. Instead, you're selectively addressing the consumers of a certain kind, and you're shaping their views in a particular way to keep your market alive, so to speak. And that's what you have in the U.S. So, and even when they're not being deceptive, they're driven by commercial interests. So, you know, and that's one of the reasons why war has turned out to be something that the American population can contemplate so easily, because it's been sold to them like that. It's been sold as a video game. You have a whole series called the Kuma War Series, which actually treats actual battles in Iraq, you know, the hunt for Saddam Hussein, the hunt for the two brothers, his sons and all that, treats it as episodes in a video game in which you participate and you kill people and you do this. And, you know, you have games like Grand Theft Auto. These are not to be taken lightly. They're part of a whole set of commercial activities which desensitize the population, make the young male population ready to accept certain sorts of activities as perfectly natural, perfectly okay. I mean, this is specifically done by and promoted by the military. We forget, apart from the fact that this is such a corporatized society, this is also a very militarized society in a way that other countries perhaps don't have any clue about. More than 30% of the population relies directly or indirectly on the defense industrial complex in some way for their living. You see this huge property boom in Washington, D.C. and in Baltimore, where I was based, is driven by hiring from the Defense Department. And people are coming from all over and being, you know, working there. So quite a lot of that boom was driven not by anything else, the Defense Department. So when you are so closely entangled in the powers that be, how can you look at it? Journalists, the general population, the technocrats, how can you look at what feeds you critically? You can't.
Well, even the use of the word defense, in the 50s they changed the War Department, Defense Department, and that was in Orwellian speak. And so now everyone speaks about the defense budget as if the United States is threatened by attack by some country.
Yeah.
One of the problems, of course, we do not have a real opposition party in this country. Haven't had one for years. And so with the media being how you describe it, and the Democrats being more the pacifiers and the Republicans, but basically not launching a real attack against the administration for this war. In fact, they supported the war and would no doubt support a war in Iran. We're faced with a dilemma.
Yeah, but I see Americans as also mavericks. I mean, look, this is a country which had Mad Magazine. It's an anti-establishment thing. I grew up with that. I saw it through Madison Avenue and all the, you know, the kind of question. I just don't believe that culturally Americans are that. So, I mean, not Germany. I mean, that people keep saying this is becoming like Germany in the 1930s and so on. And I do see the parallels. But I just think temperamentally, Americans, despite certain kinds of conformisms and rule followings, I really see them as much more of a maverick country. It's driven by immigration. It's driven by innovation, perhaps not to the degree that it used to be. But it still is driven. Perhaps now what is driving it is foreign immigrants who come in and, you know, are there in all the technical fields and so on. But regardless, it is a very cosmopolitan mixed country, in its, at least among its elites. Don't see really that there's any necessity why we should go this way. It requires a concerted effort. I mean, look at the web. It's just alive with criticism. You want to know what's going on, you go onto the internet. It's alive with criticism, blogging, people journaling all their thoughts about politics, very detailed, very sophisticated. Let me not say that it's Americans who are at fault or Americans lack the initiative or the questioning spirit. I think it's just there. I think something has been done to them systematically over the last 50 years. I don't think this is the American nature to just swallow whatever is given to them. I think they've been the victims of a very sophisticated propaganda assault that has been going on and that has gradually been concentrated into fewer and fewer hands until this moment when a group of rather unscrupulous individuals have seized power and, you know, trying to lock in the gains of having that kind of a media behind them. Doesn't have to be. I mean, I think it's a matter of a house of cards. If people got together and blew hard enough, the whole thing would fall down.
Well, we have to get together and really start blowing. Lee, I want to thank you for being our guest in this last 40 minutes. You are the author of The Language of Empire, Abu Ghraib in the American Media, published by Monthly Review Press, available from the publisher. Check with your local bookstore and see if you can get it there. You go directly to Monthly Review. It is worth time to take and read this book by Lila. Thank you so much for being our guest today, and enjoy your stay in Buenos Aires, and hope we have
Thank you, Jeff.
A change in the weather and the world.